Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Since Trump's inauguration, Elon Musk has not left the headlines with Doge, X's influence on voters, and his overall involvement in the federal government. There's no sector he has not been a part of. For a while, Tesla was able to tiptoe around the outrage. But ever since late February, its stock has taken a nosedive. From dealerships on fire to complete market shift, what is going on with Tesla and Elon Musk? Joining us now is Arion Marshall, a staff writer for Wired who focuses on transportation and cities. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi there.
So let's start with the simple question. Is the EV market struggling right now as a whole, or is it just Tesla that's struggling?
I'd say in the U.S. in particular, the EV market is definitely in a slightly strange place. Part of that is just because the entire auto industry is in a strange place right now. We keep hearing about these tariff threats from the White House. They keep getting delayed another month, another few weeks. Industries in general don't like to operate with uncertainty, and particularly one like the auto industry that has such a complex and global supply chain. But for EVs in particular, this is a weird moment. The White House has gone kind of back and forth about whether it's going to be supporting electric vehicles in the way that the last administration did. Coming into this administration, it felt like they were going to be really anti-EV. Now that Elon Musk is kind of the first buddy of the president of the United States, that may change things a bit. So it's definitely a weird time overall. But Tesla's really going through it as well.
I like that. First buddy. First best friend. So there's been failures for Cybertruck. There's been multiple recalls, the stagnation on new models, and an overall image that the brand has shaken by consumers. But with all that said, is the root of Tesla's stock woes that are happening right now, is the root of it the company, or is it Elon Musk in particular?
Oh, gosh, that's so hard to say. And I think kind of the trillion dollar question at this point, literally. Certainly, Elon Musk does not help. Tesla famously does not really have a marketing department. You don't see them, running commercials at the Super Bowl, much less running commercials at all. Their marketing is basically Elon Musk. And for a long time, that worked out really well for them. He was seen as kind of the real life Iron Man, this, mad genius who could do a million things at once. And was really able to push their product and get a lot of headlines out of it without Tesla paying a dime. Now that his reputation has really taken a turn, and particularly among Tesla's core customers, who in general are people who are pro-environment, they like the idea of driving around an electric vehicle because it's a new technology. For those people, his reputation has really changed, and therefore their feelings about the company have changed because he's so deeply linked to it.
And why are the calls for Elon Musk to step down as CEO only coming out now? You know, CEO's been fired for much less than all this, the stock tanking like this.
Yeah, I'd say you've been paying really close attention to Tesla, as I have for a number of years, there's always been people who have been kind of on the fringes, shareholders who have been a little bit wary about Elon Musk's role in Tesla and how much attention he's been giving to the car company versus his many, many other ventures. But I'd say the big difference maker right now is that we're really seeing some clear effects on the stock price. I was just looking at the numbers this morning in mid-December. Since mid-December, the stock price is down by 42%. That's a lot of money. And I think when shareholders start to see that real effect on their portfolios, that's when they get really, really nervous.
And with, comparatively speaking, there are few Teslas out on the road. So why is Tesla valued so much more, like the most valuable auto manufacturer in the world? Why does it have such a high value if there's not as many Teslas as we see, Hondas out there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it seems like in general, Wall Street has believed that Tesla is more valuable because it's not just a car company, it's also a technology company. So they have cars, sure, that you sometimes see out on the road, in particular in some parts of the country that are a bit more electric vehicle friendly. But also they've created this kind of software first vehicle. And the thing that Elon Musk has really been pushing in the past few years is that he says Tesla is really an AI and robotics company. And he has really been arguing that once Tesla produces totally self-driving cars, that basically with a switch, Tesla will be able to turn most of the Teslas on the road right now into self-driving cars, that basically the upside for the company is almost infinite.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking about Tesla stock and Elon Musk's future with the company with Arion Marshall, a staff writer for Wired who focuses on transportation and cities. So what's your take on the federal government directly advertising Tesla to the American people? You said Tesla doesn't have a marketing department, but I saw kind of an ad, with a Tesla, and President Trump.
Yeah, it was really surreal. I will say, this is not the first time that you've seen cars, and particularly electric cars, on the lawn of the White House. The Biden administration did a few events. Now, kind of famously, Tesla wasn't invited to those because the Biden administration took a really firm stance, a very firm pro-union stance, and Tesla workers are not unionized, whereas other American automakers companies are. But having this kind of real, almost kind of like crass car dealership thing happening on the White House, where they arranged these Teslas kind of in a half circle, and the White House press corps was there. It was definitely surreal and odd, and frankly, a little bit unsettling.
And the president, there's been a lot of protests at Tesla dealerships, and the president called those protests terrorist charges or something. I can't remember the exact words he used, something like that. What do you make of that, the protests at the dealerships and the president's reaction to them?
Yeah, it's been interesting because there are kind of two things happening simultaneously. You're seeing these kind of grassroots protests at Tesla showrooms and charging stations and service centers all over the country. I was just seeing this morning that one happened this last weekend in Seward, Alaska. So it's re they're really happening everywhere. And then at the same time, you're seeing these much more intense and really violent handful of attacks on Tesla showrooms. We've seen a few that have caught on fire, been graffitied, been shot at, even in Oregon. So it's sometimes hard to tell when the White House is talking about these domestic terrorism charges. Are they talking about these peaceful protesters who are just standing outside of Tesla showrooms holding their signs that are, very clearly anti-Musk, who is, a very firm ally of the president? Or are they talking about these more violent kind of things that you're seeing in the media as well?
And one of the most ironic outcomes of this whole situation is that the Tesla market swapped from liberals to conservatives. So you mentioned that with the Biden administration having electric vehicles at the White House, versus Tesla specifically being at the White House with the Trump administration. But do you think this trend can sustain the Tesla brand, conservative states having more Tesla dealerships?
I'm not sure. The interesting thing is that there are so many conservative states that actually don't allow Tesla dealerships at all because there are very firm rules as to whether automakers can do direct sales. So for in Texas, for example, which is seen as a big Tesla company, Austin plays host to a big Tesla factory, they don't even have these Tesla showrooms. So will these new allies of Elon Musk and perhaps of Tesla even have an opportunity to buy Teslas? I don't know. That's a question that's yet to be answered. I am personally a bit skeptical that Tesla can kind of neatly replace its liberal customer base with a conservative one. Conservatives have, in the past few years, generally been pretty hostile to electric vehicles as kind of a cultural concept. But stranger things have happened. So perhaps conservatives can really sustain this electric vehicle company.
Now, even people who own Teslas are, some of them are coming out against Elon Musk, and they started to put up bumper stickers on their cars. Have you seen this trend where they have a bumper sticker that they put on their car to say that, you know, they love the car? I think one of them said, "I love this car, but Elon makes me sad."
Yes, yeah, that's definitely something that's happening. And you see people who it was interesting, just a few years ago, thought they were really broadcasting something different. They thought their car broadcasted that they were really future forward, that they were environmentally friendly, perhaps even specifically that they were liberal. And now it seems to represent something different. So yeah, those bumper stickers seem to have kind of filled a particular niche in the market for those folks.
Yeah, I guess if you spent all that money on a Tesla, you're going to keep it, right? And then, yeah. So how do you see the demand for Teslas evolving? Is there an international market for Teslas?
The international market is actually right now looking even worse than the US for Tesla. Just in the past few months, the Tesla's sales in Europe, and particularly, have taken a nosedive, particularly in Germany, where the gesture that Elon Musk made after the inauguration, that, you know, some people have argued looks a lot like a Nazi salute, that was not taken well in Germany in particular, and really all over Europe. So Europe's really turned against Teslas. And the other thing that's happening, not only in Europe, but all over the world, is that, you know, the Chinese continue to make really good and pretty inexpensive electric vehicles. Now, these aren't allowed to be imported into the US for a number of kind of import control and tariff reasons, but they are really making headways all over the world and really challenging Tesla's authority as the world's premier electric vehicle maker.
These Chinese electric vehicles, so you say they're not allowed to be sold in the US, but are they being sold in Europe and around the world, other places?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is actually something I was talking about just, you know, having coffee with my colleagues recently. There's kind of a world in which you see electric vehicles and other car advances happening much faster in other parts of the world. And US starts to look, you know, somewhere a bit like Cuba, where they have these kind of outdated car technologies. You come here and go, oh, well, these people are like a little behind in terms of what they have in car technology. I think that kind of split in terms of the way the world is going right now, in terms of autos, you know, could start to look pretty stark in the next years and decades.
Will Tesla be left in the past then? If, you know, I mean, eventually the market usually wins out. So maybe the Chinese cars will end up here somehow. Will Tesla be left behind?
I think the big thing that will determine that is whether Elon Musk and Tesla can convert on their big promises they've made around autonomous vehicle technology in particular. Elon Musk has been saying for almost a decade now that autonomous vehicles are right around the corner. We're seeing a few of them now in very specific US cities operated by the Google sister company Waymo. But Tesla hasn't really created that fully self-driving technology yet. If they are able to pull that off, that could really reverse their fortunes. If they're not, they might be in big trouble.
And not that I can make you predict the future, but do you see a future where Elon Musk and Tesla are separate, or do you think they'll always remain together?
Oh, gosh, I find it really hard to envision a Tesla without Elon Musk. But I was also one of those people who said there's no way Elon Musk is actually going to buy Twitter. So maybe don't listen to me. I'm not sure.
All right. Well, we'll see what predictions come true. I want to say thank you to Arianne Marshall, staff writer for Wired magazine, reporting on transportation. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're going to talk about Intel and chips, and that is when Tech Tuesday continues from All Science on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, It's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Intel has had some hiccups over the past year. The CHIPS Act is being threatened, along with ever-slipping stock prices and many rivals cozying up to the Trump administration. However, a new CEO might be able to restart the fallen giant. Lip Bhutan, a veteran of the Silicon Valley investment firms, may be able to get Intel through these challenges. With us now is Trip Mickle, a reporter for the New York Times who is covering the U.S. semiconductor industry. Welcome to Tech Tuesday, Trip.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with President Trump's comments from his recent joint address to Congress earlier. He called the CHIPS Act a, quote, horrible, horrible thing, and he told Speaker Mike Johnson to get rid of the CHIPS Act. What do you make of those comments?
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing about them, if you put yourself in the room that evening, was that no one expected them, in part because they'd received some reassurances on the Republican side that the CHIPS Act wouldn't be a focus of the speech. And then if you watch the speech itself, President Trump is adhering pretty closely to his scripted remarks and then pauses, looks away from the teleprompter, and talks about how he believes the CHIPS Act is a horrible thing. So it really caught people by surprise. The reason for those remarks remain a bit of a mystery, but he's long been frustrated by the structure of that particular act, in part because he has believed that he could get chip companies to build plants in the U.S. without having to give taxpayer dollars and incentives to encourage that development.
Now, the CHIPS Act is an act passed by Congress, so Congress would have to undo it. Do you think the threat was serious, and do you think Congress will do it?
I think the fact that he's repeated this threat, you know, pretty consistently going back 6-7 months means he is serious about wanting to see it changed or overhauled. The problem is, and the question is, like, what does that really mean and what structure would that take? Are we talking about something like NAFTA, where they essentially kind of recrafted NAFTA, changed some of it around the edges, gave it a new name in USMCA, and then it became, you know, NAFTA under Trump, essentially? Or are we looking at something more substantive and more of a substantive overhaul that would really just do away with the act altogether? More than likely, we're probably looking at the former, because a lot of this money has been committed and contracts have been signed and companies are relying on the U.S. government to fulfill those commitments. If the Trump administration walked back those commitments, then I think going forward, you probably would be looking at a situation where very few companies would be willing to take Uncle Sam's word for it when it made some promises, along the lines of financial incentives to encourage investment in the country.
You reported that a senior official at the Department of Commerce conducted brief interviews with the CHIPS program office. That's the office that oversees these grants. Do you know how those conversations went?
Yeah, this was, in the kind of throes of DOGE sweeping through the U.S. government. And one of the commerce officials went into the CHIPS office and sat down with senior leaders there, asked them to bring their resumes, kind of proof of intellect, so to speak, like something like an SAT score or an IQ test result, and then proceeded to ask them kind of, questions over the span of 10 minutes. And some of those questions included mathematical questions like, what is 4 to the 4th power? And based on responses, people kept or lost their jobs. And for the most part, people lost their jobs. There were about 40 people laid off in the course of that week.
So you're saying people who oversee the CHIPS grants were asked to do math problems to save their jobs? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, essentially. Yeah, that's more or less what it was. Yeah. I think there was also paper put on the table for some people, and they were asked to do long division. So, yeah, math was really at the crux of whether or not you were gonna sink or swim that week at work.
That's so interesting because, I mean, if you oversee a grant office, what if you're just an expert in grants management and not an expert in math? That is fascinating.
It's a great question. I mean, a lot of these layoffs hit people in areas of the CHIPS office that that were important but maybe aren't important going forward. And some of those would be like legislative relationships, so managing kind of interactions with Congress. Now, Congress has already largely overseen and taken care of its role in the act's passage. So you can make an argument that those roles maybe aren't as necessary as they once were. But certainly with some of the more senior people, they've been there for a while, and this was part of an effort to change the leadership at the top of the program.
Now, an Intel manufacturing plant for here in Ohio, which has been delayed several times, but CHIPS funding was very important in the choice of that plant being here and where it is. Without CHIPS funding, do you think that Intel, what do you think will happen to Intel?
Oh God, that's such a loaded question.
Yeah. Sorry. We can make it a we can make it a smaller question with,
no, that's okay. I mean, Intel has really been challenged, as I know your listeners know, for more than a year now. Probably really over the past 2 years. It's been dealing with a major decline in sales. It made this huge bet on reinventing and updating and innovating around its manufacturing processes for semiconductors. That project has not fully come to fruition yet. So it's really getting pinched from both sides. It's been spending a lot of money, and it's been making less. And as a result, last year it had a big round of layoffs of about 15,000 people. And it also parted ways with its chief executive officer, who had been there and kind of come up with this new strategy, Pat Gelsinger. They recently named a new CEO, Lip-Bu Tan, who's going to be coming in and reassessing all of that and making decisions about going forward. That's a long-winded way of saying we don't know what's going to happen with Intel, right? This is new management. New management is going to have new priorities. And the fact that Ohio keeps getting kind of pushed down the road a bit suggests that Lip-Bu Tan himself is going to have to make some decisions about whether that's a project they want to see to fruition or not.
Now, Intel used to be a beacon of United States technologies and just the technology industry, but with its stock prices continuing to slowly trickle down, what do you think the core problem is for Intel?
The core problem for Intel, well, there are two problems. Intel's really it's a two-headed monster of sorts. It has a manufacturing business that makes chips, and that's called its foundry business, and then it has a design business that designs chips. Let's look at each one, and we can kind of break down what the issues are, because both those businesses have been buffeted by real adversity over the past decade. For the design business, Intel has missed really at least two of the last transformative technologies that have driven sales of semiconductors. It missed the mobile transformation in the late 2000s around the iPhone. It decided not to make those low power chips for smartphones. And then it also failed to design sophisticated GPUs, which are the chips that are used to create and develop AI systems. It's the reason that this company called Nvidia has suddenly become the second most valuable company in the world behind Apple. So you miss two big sales booms, you're going to have problems. You're really relying on legacy technology, and that's what they've been leaning on. And that's why sales have been going down. Separately, at the same time, on the foundry business, they chose not to invest in new technology and tools to improve and accelerate the capabilities of the chips they were making. And in the face of that, a competitor named Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company did make those investments and began to gobble up more of that business. So they were losing sales there and became a less appealing option for people looking to manufacture chips. I mean, in other words, they had two legs of their stool, and they basically like made both of them pretty feeble in the course of the past decade.
This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides, and we're talking about the future of Intel and semiconductors with Trip Mickle, a reporter for the New York Times who covers the U.S. semiconductor industry. So the United States originally pioneered the semiconductor industry, and Intel was a part of that. But walk us through how the United States lost its place as a leader. Was it just those misses that you were talking about where Intel missed out and over businesses overseas took the spots?
No, it wasn't just that. It's really, what happened in the semiconductor industry is really what we've seen happened with outsourcing and offshore manufacturing in general, that began in kind of the 1980s and really accelerated in the 1990s and 2000s. But in the 1980s, the U.S. began looking to Asia to manufacture semiconductors more cheaply and, more cheaply than they could in the United States itself, and that kind of shift gathered steam when Taiwan Semiconductor landed on the scene and just said, "We will essentially not design chips anymore. We're just going to make them. We will just have a manufacturing facility that cranks these things out." If for those of you who have an iPhone in your pocket, you may have heard of a company called Foxconn that does the assembly of the iPhone. Apple designs that iPhone. It sends those specs to Foxconn. Foxconn pulls together all the components, runs them down a manufacturing line, and puts them in a box and sends them to you. This is essentially the same thing that Taiwan Semiconductor does with semiconductors. It takes an order from, say, Intel or another company like Nvidia. It does, it fulfills that order by manufacturing those chips and then sends them out to where they need to be without those companies having to build the manufacturing footprint necessary to make those chips themselves.
Yeah, you mentioned that Intel makes chips and designs chips and has those two distinct functions. What's your take on the idea of splitting up manufacturing and design? Will that save Intel if they split themselves up?
Well, I don't see how that could save a company that is no longer what it was, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it would in essence create a totally different company and two companies as a result of that change. I mean, it could save the brand name Intel and a portion of the company, but another part of it, likely the foundry portion, the manufacturing portion, would become something different and possibly become something that's operated by somebody else. We haven't talked about this, but one of the possibilities that has been floated is that another company like Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing could come in and operate and manage and take a controlling interest in the manufacturing side of Intel going forward.
Yeah, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing is a key player in the chip industry, the world's biggest maker of advanced semiconductors. How does its dominance impact the United States chip market?
Well, its dominance has put it in a position to where it's made it hard for companies to compete and win business, because once you are manufacturing at the kind of scale they are, and by that I mean once you have the trust of all the customers who need semiconductors made, which is something that Taiwan Semiconductor has been able to gather over the span of several decades, it's really hard to persuade those customers to try somebody else. And so we talked a little bit earlier about how Intel has made this bet on a new manufacturing process for making chips. That's all well and good, but they also have to persuade companies that have come to know that TSMC can reliably produce their chips to leave TSMC and take a chance on this new technology. And that's just a really hard thing to pull off.
TSMC recently pledged $100 billion to build United States manufacturing plants. That includes $6.6 billion in federal grants from the CHIPS Act. It's just a mind-boggling amount of money to say $100 billion. What is that going to do to the industry here in the U.S.?
You know, what that does is it provides some guarantees for the U.S. that the supply chain for semiconductor manufacturing has been diversified somewhat. We haven't talked a lot about this, but as you will note in the name Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, most of their manufacturing is done in Taiwan, mm-hmm. the vast majority of it. And Taiwan is a country and an island that has claimed independence, but also faces the kind of threat and kind of the assumptions of the Chinese and mainland China that it is actually part of mainland China. It has become this kind of flashpoint island. And that holds the risk that if there were a change in control over Taiwan, that getting Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing chips out of Taiwan could become difficult. And so this big Arizona project and the Ohio project, all of that was really about the idea of decreasing U.S. reliance on Taiwan-made chips.
Yeah, with China's pressure over Taiwan, do you think that the investment is necessary for the United States? Because, I mean, we don't know how that'll all play out. So does this help the United States with their reliance on semiconductors by this investment?
It certainly helps, right? I mean, we went from a period at the twilight of the first Trump administration into the Biden administration where there were no leading edge manufacturing plants in the U.S. And now we're going to at least have like five leading edge manufacturers who have made commitments to build and manufacture chips in this country, which is really important. So
do you think that is the goal, that we're going to turn the Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company into an American semiconductor manufacturing company?
No, I don't think so. But I do think that, to borrow a lesson from the Cuban rum industry, and just forgive this brief digression, we can provide a little bit of security and confidence that Taiwan Semiconductor can continue to do its job. And if you go back and look at Castro taking over the island of Cuba, there were two rum companies that were really prominent at the time, Bacardi and Havana Club. Bacardi had actually set up operations in Puerto Rico. So after all the businesses on the island of Cuba were nationalized by the Castro regime, Bacardi continued to operate and remains one of the world's largest rum providers. Whereas Havana Club, really, it sells internationally, but you can't buy original Havana Club here in the U.S., the world's largest market for spirits purchases. And so you can kind of look at Taiwan Semiconductor and say, well, this at least paves a way for something similar to happen with it, where it can continue to operate should the worst possible outcome occur.
I love a good rum analogy, early in the morning, right? just as a final question, we talked more at the beginning about the new CEO of Intel, Lip-Bu Tan. How fast does he need to move? I feel like the chip industry, semiconductors, is a very fast-moving industry. If you don't make moves quickly, you get left behind, as you mentioned with Intel before. What does he need to do as CEO?
You know, he needs to make a decision pretty quickly about what he wants to do with these two sides of the business. Does he want to keep the business together or split it up? And I would assume he'll make that decision in the next few months. And if he wants to split it up, then he needs to make a decision about whether or not he wants to bring a partner in to operate the foundry business or continue to have it run by the team that's been there to date. And that would be a decision that I would expect to be crystallized sometime in the next 6 to 8 months. Once you look out beyond that, the big push that he's outlined so far is getting Intel up to speed and competitive in the world of AI chip making. That's where money is being made right now in semiconductors. And I think that's going to be the kind of the longer term project for them.
Well, thank you for your time, Trip Mickle, a reporter for the New York Times covering the U.S. semiconductor industry. Thank you for your time, Trip.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about how to finance your DoorDash orders. That's when All Sides and Tech Tuesday continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich, and this is Tech Tuesday. Klarna has recently teamed up with DoorDash, bringing its pay-in-four structure to the food delivery app. Here to tell us more about this deal is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what does Klarna do exactly? Is it kind of like a credit card?
No, it's kind of like a payday lender. Klarna is for if you've ever, you know, bought something from an online only clothing brand or, you know, a couple of different tech, you know, organizations. I think Samsung partners with them in some cases. It is essentially a deferred payment system. So you can choose to pay for that thing all up front, or you can break it up into, just as an example, four payments that you make every 2 weeks. In order to pay for that thing with relatively mild interest attached to it. You know, so it's designed to be a thing that you see as a relative, you know, way to get something faster without having to you know, pay for it. It's not exactly the same as layaway because you do still get the product the moment that you have clicked the order button, but you're basically breaking that payment up over in smaller chunks across a relatively short period of time.
Now, I thought whenever I was looking at the website, they made it seem like it's no interest payments. Is that not true?
It very much depends on how you set it up. So if this is something that you're deferring, if you're only cutting the payment, just as another example, in half, and so the other half is being paid in 2 weeks, then there's very little or no interest attached to it. But there are options, depending on where you make a purchase from, where you can extend that payment out over, say, 3 months, in which case there are some additional fees associated with that.
So that's how Klarna makes money then, is with the ones that do have interest fees, or?
That's exactly right. It's essentially, you know, kind of a microtransaction operation. And this is something that Klarna partners with individual retailers to make sure that that option is very prominently displayed on the site. Klarna has its own kind of micro credit check process that doesn't put a, you know, a mark on your credit report, but it takes a look and see, you know, make sure that you're actually able to make those payments before it agrees to make that offer to you. And then you can go through and, you know, kind of make a purchase at your own discretion.
Now, I mentioned that they partnered with DoorDash. So that made me feel like, can you do four payment installments on a $10 burrito? Like,
yes, that is the joke that has popped up over the last couple of days, is that you can use Klarna to order your Taco Bell, and that way you're paying, you know, kind of a dollar a week for this thing that you ordered. DoorDash gives you the ability to make pretty substantial purchases. You can buy things from Best Buy and you know, Walmart and things that are not just food. So, you know, the goal there from DoorDash's perspective is to make it easier to make some of those larger purchases that it has now put on its service. There is a non-trivial risk there, because groceries are also ordered through DoorDash depending on where you live. And the idea that someone is kind of short on cash and so is essentially taking on a payday loan in order to, you know, order those groceries, a little on the troubling side. But the intent here, at least from DoorDash's press releases, is for those larger payments that you would see from, you know, the Home Depot and you know, Best Buy and places like that.
I guess I use DoorDash, but only for food. So I did not realize that you could make bigger purchases on DoorDash. So I don't know. That's either shame on me or shame on their marketing company for not telling me to do that. Do you think that is this a smart decision for DoorDash to team up with them, Klarna?
I think Klarna has proven itself as a you know, kind of money-making company. They've been around for quite some time. They've partnered with some of the largest retailers on the internet. So it is a name that a non-trivial part of the U.S. market trusts. when it comes to making those kind of purchases. And you know, it is clearly a system that is working for some of these other companies. So I can see that being, you know, something that is beneficial to DoorDash, because it will encourage some of those larger purchases to get made there instead of, you know, through the retailer directly, which allows them to kind of harvest more of that revenue. But yeah, I mean, this is still something that, you know, consumers that are going to see this option will need to make sure that it's actually in their best interest before hitting the buy button.
Do you have to apply for it, or can anyone use this payment plan?
Anyone can use this payment plan. It doesn't really matter, you know, if you have a really terrible credit, they may just offer you different terms than someone else. But yeah, this is, you know, it's not meant to replace the concept of a credit card. It really is just designed for very short-term payments, just broken up into smaller groups.
And Klarna is already being used in stores like Walmart. So is this company just growing? Do you see it in eventually being in more retailers too?
Yeah, Klarna has grown pretty dramatically over the last 2 years, and there is, you know, kind of an ongoing conversation about whether this is something that will benefit consumers, especially in the absence of a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or if this will continue to be something that could potentially exploit people for, you know, maybe not necessarily reading the fine print.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we are talking with Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Next, we want to talk about Razer, which traditionally works on gaming hardware, but it is entering the developer sphere. They unveiled, is it Wyvern? Is that how you say it? Or is it W-Y?
Yes.
I didn't know if I had to say the letters. W-Y-V-R-N, Wyvern, a software development kit which integrates AI into games testing. So let's start with what does Razer primarily do right now? And then we'll get into why it's changing.
Sure. So a significant part of Razer's entire business strategy is gaming accessories for any kind of player. If you're playing on a console, if you're playing on a PC, if you're playing on a Mac, they will sell you anything that glows in pretty, pretty colors in order to make that experience better. That could be headphones, it could be keyboards or mice or microphones. It could be game controllers for your PlayStation or Xbox. The goal there is for they're very highly aesthetic. It's usually matte black with, you know, a string of rainbow LEDs across it. That you can configure to, you know, your own personal color preferences. If you've walked in any electronic store before, there's a very good chance that you have seen, you know, very bright, colorful keyboards from Razer. They also have this entire line of things that they call the Crystal line, which is all very bright pink, which my daughter is a huge fan of because it is bright pink and lots of colors. But the goal here for Razer is to extend beyond that kind of consumer peripheral. And that's what this developer tool platform is aiming at, is getting, you know, into more than just the thing after the game has been made.
Okay, so it's a software developer kit, which is used for AI for game testing. So who's the consumer here? Who's the customer for this?
So the game company, the company that makes the game, or the individual that is making a game, is the customer here. The idea is that you would buy a license to this tool, which would serve a couple of different functions. It would give you the ability to go through and see any bugs that may exist in the game, because the AI is able to play the game, you know, 100 times in a row, whereas a human being would take slower, you know, time to do that and to see some of the errors that pop up. It also gives you the ability to integrate deeper into Razer's products. So, you know, if you already have all of the Razer stuff sitting at your desk, you know, what a great thing it would be for you to cross the finish line in a racing game and all of the checkered flag stuff happens on all of the lit stuff that is around you. That sort of thing is what Razer is aiming at here.
Okay, so their goal is to get more into the AI world as well, I'm sure, because that's the future and that's what everyone is looking at. So do you think they'll still focus on the hardware and then have this as a new part?
I think both are a critical part of Razer moving forward. You know, the software component gives them that kind of monthly residual revenue, whereas, you know, a hardware purchase is very much a one-time purchase and then you're done. Razer hasn't had an enormous amount of success in having their own subscription service for consumers. So they're trying a subscription service for the people that are actually making the games and see how that works out.
Okay. So, I mean, there's a lot of people out there making games, so this is going to help people, you know, make their games better more quickly.
That is the theory. You know, the thing with all of this is that it hasn't really been tested, and there's a big question as to whether this is something that will support the human beings that are actually doing the game testing, or if it is designed to replace them. And, you know, if one is going to support, then, you know, that is likely a positive, because, you know, having a human being that can go through and actually see the bugs in the game is often very different from, you know, an AI that is going through and experiencing that. So if this is a supportive tool and not a replacing tool, then it could end up being quite positive.
Okay, I see. So there's people whose job it is, they're hired by gaming companies to play the game over and over and over again and figure out what's wrong with it.
That's exactly right. These people sit with they got one monitor that's the video game, and then another monitor that's like a developer console where they can see, you know, where things are breaking and you know how they can, you know, recommend a fix for it. That is very much a job in every single video game that has been made for as long as we've been alive. And so that, you know, that process, you know, is often quite time consuming and quite tedious. And so having these tools to help those people could be pretty beneficial.
Okay. So as long as they don't replace the people, we're saying that this is a good, faster, easier way to get the job done.
I would think so. I would say that any tool like this, you know, we see Microsoft doing something not terribly dissimilar for some of their, you know, kind of internal tools, and they're not explicitly designed to replace humans at the moment, because, you know, it's still really important to have human eyeballs on some of this stuff. But it could be a step in the future where, you know, there's a developing house that decides it only needs these tools in order to make a game good enough to ship.
All right. And another topic that we have for today is Google is coming out with its Pixel 9a, which is set to compete with the new iPhone 16e, especially with the price range. So what is the price for this new Google phone, the Pixel 9a?
This is going to start at $500 for the basic, you know, kind of no frills version of this phone. The Pixel 9a is very much, you know, Google has had and what they call the A series. For the Pixel phones for the past couple of years. It usually launches right around here in the spring. It is basically a lot of the things that were really, really great about the phone that they announced in October, but at a much cheaper price because it either has a smaller battery or fewer cameras or something in order to offset that cost. This year was actually the first time that Apple released something similar in what it is now calling its E-series, and it did so at $600, which is about $200 cheaper than kind of the base level iPhone that would get announced later on. But the goal there is essentially to have that you know kind of budget phone for people who are looking to upgrade but maybe not looking to spend, you know, $1,500 on something new.
And does this new Pixel phone have anything that the iPhone doesn't? Is it just, you know, there's a Team Pixel, Team iPhone? Is this phone better? Yeah.
You know, so Google has, for its Pixel line, often focused really heavily on letting its software do a lot of the talking. So it has a really, really great camera, but that camera is entirely because there's a lot of post-processing and, you know, kind of AI stuff that's going on in the background to make that picture better than what it is that you actually see with your eyes, which, you know, last year when it released, this was a huge question about how these phones could be used for photojournalists because it was no longer, you know, it was no longer an accurate representation of what was going on in front of you. But as far as, you know, consumers taking a picture of the Grand Canyon, you know, the best shot you can possibly get, the better, right? Mm-hmm. So the goal there is to bring that functionality down to something that is considerably less expensive.
Now, one of your reviewers at CNET really loved the Pixel 8a. It won a CNET Editor's Choice Award. So are we going to like the 9a that much?
Definitely going to need some additional testing to be sure, because with any Pixel, the biggest question isn't whether or not it is a fun phone to use, because they typically are, but the battery life is something, especially as companies add new features to cameras and things like that, if the battery cannot last a full day of heavy testing, then it's probably not going to last you through a full day of an important life event. So, you know, making sure that kind of thing is part of our testing is always really important. But the early signs are really promising that this is a very cool phone.
Okay, so you mentioned some of the biggest positives. Is the battery maybe one of the negatives? What's other negatives for it?
Really, you know, the big negative for any phone right now is whether or not you're interested in having AI on your phone. You know, Google started this quite a long time before we called it AI. What they called it was machine learning at the time, where, you know, a lot of stuff was, you know, kind of automated recommendations and, you know, whether or not you would like a robot to call and place a recommendation for, or rather a reservation for a restaurant or a haircutting appointment. You know, those are all things that Google has baked into every one of its phones. And if you are on board with having that kind of virtual assistant work with you, then great. But it is becoming increasingly difficult to turn those features off, whether you are a Pixel fan or an iPhone fan. And so being able to, you know, use the phone the way that best suits your purposes really ends up being kind of the most important thing there.
All right. Well, we have about 2 minutes left. And last week you were on and we briefly talked about the Amazon spring sale. Has there been updates on the sale?
They have. So the sale started in earnest today, and very much like we suspected last week, a huge part of what you're going to see on sale today are, you know, kind of those big ticket items at relatively low prices. So laptops from HP and Lenovo, AirPods are on pretty great discounts right now, but also a lot of outdoor stuff. So outdoor patio sets are on pretty steep discounts, as well as new grills. You know, there's a lot of those kind of bigger purchase items that you wouldn't normally see in a spring sale that are on fairly substantial discounts.
Now, is Amazon doing this sale right now because of all the worries about tariffs? Or are they just making up a holiday?
I doubt that Amazon is going to come out and say that directly. They did start the spring sale for the first time last year, and this is happening at the same time. But this event is almost twice as long as it was last year, and that is likely because Amazon understands that there is a very real opportunity to have some of these discounts available quite literally days before some of these tariffs are going to take effect.
Okay. Well, how long did you say the spring sale lasts? It's longer?
This is going to last until Sunday, whereas previously it was only 2 days. This year it'll actually be 7.
Okay. So buy your big items before they are more expensive, I guess, with Tara, right?
That seems to be the case, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. That is Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thanks for joining us again, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And this is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I want to say thank you to our staff, senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our student producers Chris Corcoran, David Stein, Iza Huck, and Colin Simpson. Video production is by the Ohio Channel, and board operation is by Cameron Howard and Chris Johnston. Thank you so much for joining us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.